I'd like to call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:31 p.m. on Monday, February 6th. We're in a meeting today in room 205 in the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phone as a courtesy. Present committee members are Senator Van Imhoff, Senator Giesel, Senator Begich, and myself, Senator Wilson. We may expect Senator Michicki to come in a little later. Today we'll hear an overview of the department and its consultants on the three recently released privatization studies and feasibility studies. First up, we have Elastic Psychiatric Institute Privatization Feasibility Report from Mr. Jones, the project manager of Public Consulting Group, will present via telephonic. And joining him will be Randall Burns from the Division of Behavioral Health. So when you guys are ready, you may begin.
Hi, this is Coy Jones. I'm with calling out of Austin today, Austin, Texas today. I'm with a Public Consulting Group, and I was the project lead for this feasibility study. Unless Director Burns has anything he wants to say as a prelude, I'm happy to kind of jump into the presentation that we have for you today.
Mr. Chairman, this is Randall Burns. Thanks, Coy Jones, for being here. I just wanted to mention the contract for this was issued in the summer, and it was competitively bid. PCG is well known, I think, within the state. They have done numerous studies on behalf of the department and the state and the legislature, as a matter of fact. And actually, a small piece of information before I turned over Coy. PCG was involved in the study that led to the determination of the current size of API back in early 2000s. So, Coy, go ahead.
Okay. I'm trusting that you have in front of you a copy of the presentation. In case that's being projected anywhere, I'll signal to Director Burns to move the presentation forward. But what I want to go over is, first of all, just the basic kind of methodology and an overview of the study. What our scope was and how we approached the questions around privatization, and then go at a very high level, go through our findings and recommendations, and then open the floor up to questions. It's a pretty multifaceted study, so we understand that there could be quite a few questions around different aspects of it. We can go ahead and start on slide 4 on stakeholder feedback. Just talk briefly about the sources of information we relied on. We received a real wealth of data, financial and service data, from API. And we supplemented a lot of that data with stakeholder feedback from all kinds of stakeholders across the state. We tried very hard to do a comprehensive round of discussing the range of issues with just about anybody who would likely be impacted. I don't go into some of the other. Some of the other research that we did that's detailed a little bit more in the report, but we also looked very closely at other privatization efforts in the last 10 years around mental hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, as well as doing a literature review on privatization in other sort of similar contexts, general hospitals, private prisons, just to see if there are any sorts of clues or lessons learned from privatization efforts across the country. So as you see in the stakeholder feedback slide, we got feedback from really all branches of state government, including the Alaska court system, which is potentially heavily affected by a privatization effort, as well as a lot of the executive departments, not just related to health and social services, but Department of Administration related to the effects on the retirement plan, workers' compensation, what ramifications there might be from the Department of Law. And we also talked to a range of providers, both hospital providers as well as community behavioral health providers, tribal and non-tribal providers, and a number of advocacy groups throughout the state, and former patients at API, and of course some of the affected, potentially affected labor unions and trade associations involved. So with all that information that came through, we synthesized that to identify four basic options. And I'm moving now to slide five. So the four options sometimes have sub-options. So we came up with a pretty large slate of potentials here. But at a high level, we're talking about a full privatization option where pretty much everything but the facility itself would be privatized. It was a part of the conditions of the procurement that API itself wouldn't be sold, but that it would be leased out or have a private operator come in as a property manager. But the rest of the operations would be privatized under option one. Option two is a variant of that, in the sense that it creates a new legal entity would be created that is a partnership between the state and a private entity through a joint operating agreement. And there are several ways that could be set up, either as a public corporation along the lines of the mental health trust currently, or as a 501c3 nonprofit. So that option isn't really different financially or from a service delivery perspective from the first option, but we did detail how it involves a slightly different legal setup. And then option three is not privatization. It's a public alternative to privatization. So what sort of new efficiencies could be implemented under the current management structure, and is that a competitive way to find cost savings or improve service delivery? And then it's really an option four that you get into the nitty-gritty of little components of operations at API. Well, these are a variety of outsourcing operations. So we identified really four main areas that we thought, at least going into the study, were potential components that could be separated out of API for privatization. One is the communication center, which is essentially the security functions of API. It's the front desk reception, but also also the staff that go into kind of controlling who enters and exits through API. It's a small area, but it is a modular component of API that could be privatized. Other aspects that could be privatized very discreetly are just a lot of the things that go into operations. So maintenance and environmental services. We're calling that facility and material management. Then looking at the psychiatric and medical staff. So really looking at privatizing the physician staff at API. And option 4D is the privatization of nursing staff. And that's about 58% of API, so it's really the bulk of API and the bulk of the service, the direct care that happens at API. And then the fourth option is really, we're calling it comprehensive outsourcing. It's essentially outsourcing everything but the administration and management of API. Those would remain state employees, but they would be overseeing direct services that are supplied by a different operator. So those were the options, and I'll go into the findings and recommendations around those. But before that, I want to go into a little bit of the assumptions that went into our study on slide six. Keeping in mind that a lot of these things we're dealing with are hypothetical, so it's very important to lay out the assumptions that we used. The first, I'll go through kind of our cost assumptions around operations. In all of our models, capital costs essentially remain the same. You're going to have them whether it's a state entity or a private entity, and we didn't see that they would be handled really differently under either entity, that the cost profile would remain the same. We assume different margins in our models based on whether we're talking about a for-profit or a non-profit entity. And we essentially did a model at someone who's got a 4% model, 4% margin and an 8% margin, thinking those are representative of for-profit and non-profit. 8% is what's often claimed on RFPs for psychiatric hospitals, for for-profit providers that bid on privatization. They usually claim that 8% profit is what they would take. With salary and benefit benchmarks that we used, we relied pretty heavily on, I think, probably the paramount case of psychiatric hospital privatization that's occurred in the country in Florida. South Florida State Hospital was privatized in 1999. It's really the only example of a full-scale privatization of the whole facility. We're fortunate to have pretty extensive cost data and service delivery data, not only for that hospital, but all of its sister hospitals in the state that remained under state management, and that allowed us to see differences in salary and benefits between a state hospital and a private provider within the same system. What we saw there is that while total compensation goes down, salaries generally go up for the private employees. So we, based on what we saw in that hospital data, our models increase salaries for the employees by about 13.7%. But then the benefits are reduced pretty extensively. That reflects differences in the state retirement plan as well as health insurance costs and other sorts of benefits. Currently, API is about 36% of compensation is represented by benefits, and we, under a private provider, that would be closer to about 22%, which is kind of reflective of private providers in the state currently. There will be some additional legal costs that are not internalized to API right now because they're part of the state system that a private provider would have to internalize, and that's about 0.3%. It's not big, but we do represent it in our model. And then a private provider we think would behave probably a little bit differently in how it uses overtime. We made some adjustments that project a reduction in overtime, as well as there's some differences currently between state policy where full time is really 37.5 hours a week. It would be 40 under a private provider, and that changes some of the overtime costs. Moving to the next slide, 7, there are some special transition costs that are also involved. So regardless of operations, there are some costs that will be incurred inevitably in a transition. One is related to IT. We think that it would be a big source of savings potentially to bring in a private provider in terms of IT because they would have their own IT structure. Currently, the state is facing a major upgrade of its IT at API. The medical record system, Meditech, is, if not already, about to be out of compliance, and there will be what's projected to be a $2.1 million upgrade cost that could be avoided under a private provider. So we included those costs in our baseline. And then retirement costs, when these public employees are removed from the system, there will be some additional termination liability to the retirement fund. The Department of Administration, based on some similar cases, estimated that would be around $2 million. So we're relying on their estimate there. So that's a $2 million in additional costs for privatization. And then for our options that are under full, that are less than full privatization, we just scaled that number proportionately. So if there's 250 FTEs at the hospital and the different option we're proposing privatizes 50 of them, then we just take the proportion of that 2 million represented by that FTE. And then finally, we needed to estimate what the likely procurement and contract monitoring costs would be that the state, these are new costs that the state would have due to its changed role as the monitor of a private contract. Our estimate there was that the cost for monitor, ongoing monitoring, as well as the original procurement, would be about 15% of the total contract cost. And that's based on estimates that you often find in the literature around privatization and what contract monitoring would cost. Our revenue assumptions, API isn't just cost. It does generate some revenue that offsets its total cost through insurance, Medicaid, a small bit of Medicare. For our revenue assumptions, we assumed that the revenue would remain roughly the same. We didn't make any changes. It would be exactly the same in our model under the assumption that that there wouldn't be kind of significant new revenue coming from a private provider. Unlike a general hospital, you couldn't add like a maternity ward to generate new revenue. There's not a lot of revenue generating service lines that you can put in at a psychiatric hospital. So the revenue assumptions is that the revenue basically remains the same. So around moving to slide 8 around service delivery assumptions. So we relied on a couple of sources to figure out exactly what staffing needs to look like. There have been some recent clinical reviews at API of the nursing staff and potential inefficiencies that are there. So we were able to rely pretty heavily on those. A lot of stakeholder comment. There's quite a few people who have perspectives on what could be done better at API. So those were very helpful kind of clues as to where we ought to look. Beyond that, we also had access to a lot of peer state hospitals. How are other hospitals that are relevantly similar to API? How do they operate? What are their staffing levels? So we compared API to what the situation looks like in a lot of other states. And then in a limited set of cases, there are some kind of clinical guidelines around how many psychiatric nurses you need. So there are some nursing staff ratio literature that we were able to rely on as well. The stakeholder interviews and the clinical reviews were very helpful in pointing out to us where there are places where there may be too much administrative overhead currently, particularly around overtime, particularly around the way that schedules are set up now. That could be established more efficiently, where there's shift overlap, but you don't necessarily have to have it. When we propose reductions, whenever possible, we propose a reduction based on, an actual situation at the hospital that we understood to be, this is a change that you can make on the ground at the hospital and get a reduction this way. But after we did those sort of targeted reductions, we did compare the FTE levels that we were left at with what the situation looks like in other peer hospitals to see whether, these cuts are kind of plausible at in comparison to how other hospitals run. So moving on to slide 9, this table is, I think, an important look at just where these staffing levels ended up. If you look at in the middle API baseline, it compares most closely with a small peer group, though it runs a little high in relation to other state hospitals. We noted that, but it's probably not going to get, because it's not a large hospital, it's always going to have higher administrative overhead than many other state hospitals. There's going to be a similarity even between large hospitals and small hospitals on things like nursing ratios, as you can see. When we ended up making our recommendations, that still looks very close to what small peer hospitals look like in terms of their basic staffing. But we do believe that there are some significant cuts that could be made, both in different levels of administration and indirect costs, as well as some reductions in nursing. The main difference between the staffing models that we recommend for the private provider and under kind of a revised state management structure is in administrative services. We think a private provider just not just by motivation, but by its nature as a private provider that is probably a part of a larger practice is going to have lower administrative costs. Whereas a state provider, if API is the only hospital in the entire system, it has to bear all the administrative costs itself. So you'll see some differences in the recommended privatized staffing for administrative costs versus state managed. But our recommendations for the direct care staffing is the same between both models. So moving to slide 10, where did we make our reductions? Well, we believe in administrative costs that there are going to be some built-in efficiencies for a private entity. They're going to have their own IT, and they're going to be able to absorb a lot of the costs that are related to IT, as well as some kind of basic administrative functions like quality assurance. So that's going to be absorbed within a larger corporate structure. So we made a lot of cuts there. And we assume that API could at least run at an administrative level that's comparable to small peer hospitals. And the small peer hospitals are all state-managed hospitals as well, so we thought they could probably be a little bit lower even with a private operator. And then in our nursing reductions, we did identify some potential areas of inefficiency. So we assumed API could do more with less in some cases. We looked at what the actual requirements were for minimum staffing on the floor, both like physically how many nurses need to be on the floor, as well as how many nurses on average nursing staff, not just nurses but their aides, need to be available, and so that brought us down to a lower staffing level. Okay, I realize I'm a little bit short on time, so I'm going to go ahead and just jump right to the findings and recommendations and on slide 12. So in full privatization, we did see that there are some potential benefits around, you have more flexible compensation structures. The DBH no longer has this burden of administering these services directly. A private contractor may be able to implement some efficiencies that a state manager just may not be able to do, both by virtue of bargaining agreements as well as just kind of the nature of working for a state, the state employee. But we did find that it was cost prohibitive. We didn't see ultimately that there would be any additional savings in full privatization, and it was not clear that you could cut down to a budget neutral arrangement without cutting service delivery too low. And that's true of both full privatization as well as the joint operating agreement. So moving to slide 14 with state management, we found that this is actually the greatest possibility for cost savings actually comes under new efficiencies implemented under state management. Even though the staffing expenditures are higher under a state management, not having the margins that would go to a not-for-profit or for-profit provider, or the additional overhead related to contract monitoring, ultimately allows you to reap the benefits of those efficiencies that come from staff reductions without those kinds of new costs being piled on. Now, one of the potential drawbacks is a question of whether these efficiencies can be implemented under state management. There are questions as to whether it would be possible to do the reductions with under current bargaining agreements. There's nothing that prohibits you legally from it, but there are pressures there. Uh, may, when it remains under public management. But this is the biggest potential for cost savings and potential service delivery improvements. Moving to slide 16, the communication center, even though it's not a big area for cost savings, it's kind of the most clearly beneficial option for privatization. So there are it would be very straightforward to hire a private security company to man the front desk 24 hours a day with fewer people involved and significant cost savings there. So almost 60% of what current costs are. And moving to slide 18, we found that our results there were fairly similar to the communication center. We didn't see as many savings, but you could privatize these services, the environmental services, maintenance costs. You could privatize a lot of those services without to do it for cheaper under a private operator without affecting service delivery, because these are really indirect costs. And don't involve any services with patients. Looking at slide 20, this is option 4C, when we look at the question of privatizing physician staff, they are a high cost level practitioner. We find that with privatization, however, that physician costs generally don't go down, they go up, because they're paid better under a private provider, because the private provider has flexibility to do that, and they often do that to support retention. Retention of psychiatrists is a huge issue. It's kind of a basic supply problem nationwide. We find that one of the things that a private provider does is they often hire more psychiatrists and pay them more than a state operator does. So we found that that would be an enormous new cost to the state if you privatize that. We didn't see that was viable financially. And then slide 22 with the nursing staff outsourcing. We did find that there are cost savings there because of the changes in compensation and the fact that it deals with about 58% of the hospital's total employees. However, we came short of making a full recommendation. If you look on the slides, we've got this yellow caution hand. Proceed with caution. Even though there are cost savings there, this is the core group of practitioners that are involved in direct services. And we had no real good way of understanding what the effects of changing that compensation package would have on retention, on hiring and retention. Already, API has a hard time being competitive with other employees for very highly valued and scarce labor force with nursing, and we didn't know exactly how it would how those sorts of changes would affect the ability of API to retain nursing staff. And another issue is we're not clear what the market for that sort of vendor would be. Where we've seen just the nursing staff privatized in other states, there's usually some significant resources both at universities and private providers where there's significant nurse training programs and the vendors there are community providers that have a lot of nursing resources. You can just kind of come into the hospital and take it over. It wasn't clear that sort of market exists in Alaska or the Anchorage area. So even though we did find that it's feasible, we're kind of putting some big kind of caution marks around whether that's truly viable when you consider the market conditions. And then our last option was the comprehensive outsourcing, which essentially takes all these outsourcing options and puts them together. That we didn't find it was viable to outsource all direct services, mostly because privatizing the physicians would be a little more would make the overall outsourcing more expensive. So we did not recommend that for that reason. So that was, again, very high level, but I wanted to make sure we kind of covered all the main points. So I'm that is my presentation, and I'm happy to receive questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Before we go with questions, I just want to let the record show that Senator Michiki came in at 1:40 p.m. Any questions from the senators? Well, Senator Begich.
You had an option, too, but it's not in the – did I miss it in the presentation?
So the option two, there's no significant difference from a financial or service delivery perspective from option one. So in fact, I talked about them together. There are some differences in the legal and how the legal entity is set up, but they don't have financial or service delivery ramifications. So everything that I said about option one applies to option two.
Yes, Senator Begich.
A second question for you: are nurses staffed at API paid more than the private sector in Alaska?
So they are, from a salary perspective, they're paid less than the private sector, but in terms of total compensation, they're paid a little bit more because of the retirement benefits, largely.
And Mr. Jones, and when you're comparing our hospitals with terms of API, was the client population thus roughly the same in terms of the other for the staffing ratios for the nurses or floor staff when you were comparing these?
With other hospitals in the state?
No, just
peer hospitals across the country?
The peer hospitals across the country.
Okay, sorry. We didn't have access to a lot of the data about Alaska-specific hospitals. We found that there is some variation within the state hospitals that we saw, but for the most part, we found that the API staffs higher than all of these small peer hospitals. Not by huge margins, but they were clearly overstaffed in relation to even small hospitals that treat the same kinds of patients. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Senator Venema?
Thank you very much for your presentation. It was clear and well researched. The questions that I have now, and I think maybe it's even more for the committee, is what now? What next?
Well, I'm not sure if
That's certainly a good question. We did look at certain efficiencies that we think can be implemented at API. I would also add to be sort of cautious. There's more work to do around what sorts of reductions could happen at API because the data that we're relying on comes from fiscal year 2015, which we needed to do to make a kind of complete analysis to understand the financial ramifications, as well as the service delivery ones. But it's not a closed system, so things have changed at API since FY15. There's more census pressure. The system looks different 2 years later. There are potentially more beds. More inpatient beds coming online in the next year or two at other hospitals in Alaska, which could decrease that census pressure and make it even easier to reduce some of the staffing numbers. Or there might not be any significant census change, in which case the reductions that we recommend, may not, they were viable for that FY15 window we're looking at, but may not be viable now. In terms of the what now, we've definitely seen some recommendations where there are some limited cases of privatization that we would recommend implementing. They're easy to do and they will generate some cost savings. But But the sort of the core reductions that could happen at API, it will need some fairly close review of what API's utilization is currently and what it's expected to be in the next year or two to figure out what a safe reduction is.
And I'm going to ask a quick follow-up question then. Maybe this is for the department to answer. So with the recommendations, some of them, I believe in option three, you guys can probably start carrying out now. Is it the goal of the department to implement some of these recommendations going forth or come up with an implementation plan later, or you're waiting for our sort of legislative intent to how to proceed going forward?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. The answer is that for the recommendation, for instance, around the communications center, we certainly will, it's our intent to pursue that here and put out an RFP for the privatization of that discrete operation within the hospital. As to the rest, particularly around the management of the core business of the hospital in terms of its clinical services, that's a matter that, Mr. Jones pointed out, really requires some additional thought. And it is our belief that it's so much of what API experiences reflects on the system, the larger behavioral health system, that it is our opinion that we really need to take into consideration those efforts that we're putting into around the 1115 and the waiver application to CMS, and also to include in our thinking about the 1115 and the fact that we're seriously bringing on an administrative services organization to help us manage the behavioral health system, that in fact we should include in our discussions with any prospective ASOs, administrative services organizations, whether or not managing API would be something that should be a part of that contract. We have asked our consultants if there are other states that have administrative services organizations operating, whether or not, in fact, there are public psychiatric hospitals that they are managing. And we have found three states so far where their public hospital, at least one of their public hospitals, is being managed as a part of an ASO. So we are certainly very sensitive to the pressures on API and its needs, and we also recognize that it has some administrative difficulties. And so we would think about those and do be planful as a part of our going forward with the reform of the behavioral health system as a whole.
Senator Baggage had a question.
Yes, I just heard Coy say that FY15 is what these numbers are based on. Was there reductions? He described overstaffing. Were there cuts in FY16 and 17 to the overall staffing of API? I mean, is it still overstaffed to the level it was in FY15 when he made, you know, as he makes that statement, Director?
The staffing is essentially the same in terms of numbers between FY15 and APIs. I think it was 250, and presently it's 249, so it's essentially the same.
And just a very quick follow-up.
Yes, sir.
And the number of patients during that time, too? What's the average, you know, for the year spent?
Right. Senator Baggage, through the chair, I think that's really one of the issues. The PCG report spent a lot of time looking at the whole report, looking at the issues around the admissions pressures on API and its impact on the staff. And that is a significant issue. API presently, and I think this is a factor that Mr. Jones was referencing, API presently in FY16 and 17 was at 92% of average 92% of occupancy during the year. the I think it's once you get over 85%, it has significant impacts on staffing ratios. And I think that that's an issue that we really believe needs further examination, given API's admission pressures. And I think, in fact, if I'm recalling correctly, since FY15, we went up to over 25,000 patient days in FY16, which was considerably above FY15. And it's that's because of the high rate of occupancy and the capacity.
Thank you. All right, so I guess I have one follow-up question here. Mr. Marion, would it be feasible to ask for sort of a timeline of after four-year plan of implementation for some of these changes and sort of a outline of what can be done now, what's going to be done, and what projects you're going to look at in the future in terms of implementing some of these cost-saving measures that won't impact sort of quality of services at API?
Mr. Chairman, that's certainly a fair question, and I think the answer is yes. I think the question, though, and the reason I say it like that is because, API is at 80 beds because we studied and then decided that the studies that we had paid for were wrong about the growth potential of the system, and we built an 80-bed hospital. And I think that before we move forward in making decisions about restructuring API, we have to really be sure about the system itself and its capacities. Mr. Jones mentioned the fact that there are some hospitals, for instance, considering bringing on mental health units. That would have a significant impact on what we were to do. Not that we would necessarily wait for that, but we certainly would want to explore just how serious that really is as an option. And so I would say, and I think it's I'm being sincere, that we are going to consider this as a part of our moving forward in 1115, and we're definitely going to be looking at API as sort of a separate function within the system, because it is such a key part of the changes that we're going to have to make, and admittedly an expensive one.
You got further questions? Oh. Yes, Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the department focused then on entering into conversations with the other facilities that could be opening up some beds? It seems to me that would be that community collaboration is a critical part. You know, when I hear the department talking about applying for 1115 waivers and we have a report like this that talks about inefficiencies, to me that translates into let's get more federal money to continue to fund an inefficient system. And that doesn't feel acceptable to me.
Senator Giesel, through the chair. I agree that that does not sound like a good solution. I agree with you. I think the real issue is what it is we can do with the system that we have and the resources that these communities have to change API. I, for instance, I, as you probably know, was the CEO at API for a few years. I'm very conscious of what it takes to run that facility, and particularly now, I think we have to be very conscious of the pressures on it. And so, yes, the state is, in fact, has talked to other hospitals. We've been approached. We're aware of hospitals that are thinking about doing this one in Anchorage, which would be really useful. And there's and also one that's thinking about developing essentially a psych emergency room like in Providence for their community. Both of those would be really welcome changes and would substantially improve the pressures on API. I just think we have to know more than just that they're interested. We have to, you know, get some confirmation that they're going to proceed. As to the, you know, the overstaffing at API, I definitely agree that, and we have a study from a study on the nursing administration that suggests that that's really where some of the changes need to occur. We need to better deploy some of our staff in nursing administration, return some of those staff to the floors where we actually do need nurses. We're short on nurses for the floors. And so those kinds of adjustments we can make, but I want to, as Mr. Joines pointed out, we live in a bargaining unit system, and changes of that nature are need to be negotiated, and they need to be, you need to move forward cautiously. And so those things take time, and I think it's really important that we give that under the existing option three, which is to essentially, you know, not privatize, but bring on efficiencies. We estimate that could take somewhere between 12 to 18 months to fully bring into practice.
Yes, Senator Giesel?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand the challenges with the union system that we operate under. One of the pieces that isn't often talked about when we're talking about state government is systems. And in this case, I'm actually very interested in outcomes for people. That is, the patients being treated. And so I'd be interested in some of that information as well. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, we can certainly, it's a huge part of the 1115 is actually developing the outcomes, the measures that we think are really important, and we absolutely agree with you on that point.
Thank you, Mr. Joines, and thank you, Mr. Burns, for your presentation today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Coy.
Next up, we'll have the Juvenile Justice Facilities Privatization Feasibility Report from Carl Becker, Senior Vice President of Carter Global Lee. And please make sure you state your name for the record. We can take a brief at ease for transition. Record. Due to a technical glitch, we'll postpone the Juvenile Justice Facilities Privatization Report until after the Pioneer Pharmacy Service Privatization Feasibility Study. We'd like to ask for Ms. Vicki Wilson, Director of the Division of Pioneer Homes, to come, and I also believe John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of Healthcare Policy and Medicaid.
I'll sit here. I promise not to touch the buttons.
Okay. And for the record, please state your name.
For the record, my name is Vicki Wilson, Director of the Alaska Pioneer Homes.
And for the record, I'm John Sherwood. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services.
Well, I have no slides. And I have no consultant, but pursuant to the bill, Senate Bill 74, the privatization feasibility study that was requested for the pharmacy within that operates for all six of the homes, we put out to bid at two different times in the spring. July and in May, for a request for proposal, and we did not, neither time were there people that met the minimum requirements. So the study actually, after that, we did not proceed with any other. They made adjustments in the second time to be able to actually see if, you know, make sure our writing of it was, you know, what the request we were doing was what, you know, would draw someone in. But we found that there was no interest in it. There was one applicant, but met the same applicant for both times, and they didn't even meet the minimum requirements for it. So that is really the extent of where we were at with any type of study. So I don't know if we've reviewed it ourselves and have our own kind of data and review that we could actually give you, because there's been questions about where we're at with our own pharmacy. And I can kind of, if you would like to hear that from a non-consulting studier of the actual homes, but having worked within the Pioneer Homes for the past 18 years with from the time that we actually made a switch over from multiple private carriers, the state in the late 90s decided to go to their own pharmacy, one pharmacy, to be able to see if we could more economically meet the needs of our residents and to reduce the cost to the state at that time. And so that started at approximately in 1996, where we did do that shift.
A timeline. Is a new timeline established of sending this back out to RFP to meet sort of those conditions in 74?
Mr. Chair, at this point, rather than simply put out another RFP, we have been in discussions with the Department of Administration to look at to see whether they have some resources we might be able to use to help us take a look at the pharmacy and some of the other operations. But we sort of, as Director Wilson indicated, we put out our first RFP. We put in what we thought were reasonable standards. We didn't generate interest or minimal interest. And second time, we tried to write our standards a little broader, make sure that we weren't being too specific. We still, again, only got the one respondent, the same respondent. So rather than just trying to do the same thing over and over again, we've been looking at whether we can find some other resources. It you know, probably our best guess is that this is a specialized enough question there just aren't a lot of people out there that do this kind of work and potentially as impactful as it could be. We do want to make sure if we hire somebody, they have the adequate qualifications to do a good job.
Senator Giesel?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could just ask a couple broad questions related to the Medicaid reform bill. So one of the things we heard in the past was that there were, when we did the audit of the Pioneer Homes, and this was legislative budget and audit, one of the findings was that the residents weren't necessarily applying for Medicaid when they became eligible for it, and that was part of the budget gap. I noticed that in the report about the cost of the pharmacy, that it looks like you're short about $250,000 or so on the cost of medications. Is that helped by encouraging more of the residents who qualify to apply for Medicaid?
Well, actually, through the chair to Senator Giesel, they are actually Medicare D is what really affected a lot of and a lot of where our costs were at too, because Medicare D, they are required, everyone is required to have that or have another resource, another insurance company that will make that coverage. And that has actually, I think, been a tremendous change in it. And so that $250,000 is and in just a broad overview, could be reviewed. I mean, we could really analyze it, and if we were to go through another process, I believe that that cost would even be less than that. But they are all residents, anyone who applies to the Pioneer Homes and moves in is required to be on Medicare D. But when Medicare D came into place, that actually did make a big difference. We have financially, but it did change also because in the past, that pharmacy made money. Before the whole Medicare D process came in and changed kind of how medications were acquired by the elderly.
Senator Giesel, follow-up?
One other follow-up. So another subject that came up in the Pioneer Home audit had to do with controlled substances and one of the facilities not having a secure process there. And can you offer assurance that that's been remedied?
Through the chair to Senator Giesel. Yes, that was they were never not secure, but they were handled in a process that was more very old school. And so that process, they were brought into compliance before the actual study was finished. And so there's definitely the security is there within that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Ms. Wilson or Mr. Sherwood? Right. Thank you. We'll take another brief at ease for transition. Back on the record. With us today is the Juvenile Justice Privatization Feasibility Report with Mr. Becker, and we have, I'll let you guys introduce yourselves for the record, and for the presentation, if we can go about 20 minutes so we have enough time for questions from the committee, would be wonderful.
Good afternoon. For the record, I am Barbara Murray, Acting Director of the Division of Juvenile Justice. As authorized by SB 74, the department contracted with Carter Goble Lee to conduct a study of the feasibility of privatizing services at select DJJ facilities. The department identified four standalone detention facilities: Matsu Youth Facility, Kenai Peninsula Youth Facility, Ketchikan Regional Youth Facility, and the Nome Youth Facility. The Ketchikan facility was closed in September of 2016, but remained as part of the study to evaluate the impact of the closure. These facilities provide detention services for youth needing secure confinement who are facing criminal charges and awaiting outcome of court processes and placement. The division appreciates the tremendous efforts of Mr. Becker and his team to complete this thorough study. And at this point, I will turn it over to Mr. Becker to present his study.
And for the record, my name's Carl Becker. I'm a senior vice president with CGL. Got a brief presentation here we'll go through quickly, so you all have time for questions.
Mr. Becker, if you can pull the mic a little closer to you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Just an overview of who we are. We are basically one of the oldest, largest criminal justice consulting firms in the country. We've been doing this since 1976, and our specialty is performance evaluations, operational reviews, program analyses, program evaluations for justice systems, both adult and juvenile. We've done work throughout the United States and, in fact, have done a couple projects here in Alaska. We did the legislative audit of the Department of Corrections 2 or 3 years ago, and then more recently did an analysis of staffing in the Department of Corrections. The objectives of this project were to determine the feasibility of privatizing the operation of the state's standalone juvenile detention facilities, and then to basically assess what value they provided the state and identify any potential alternatives that would possibly be made available by these facilities and establish their highest and best use. Our approach was multifaceted. We collected a lot of data from the department in terms of the youth served by the system, the facilities themselves, how the system is organized and operated, the programs that are provided in these facilities. We spent a good deal of time talking to staff to get their perspective on the system and the facilities, not just facility staff, but probation staff and administrative staff as well. We spent a good amount of time at the facilities themselves to familiarize ourselves with their operation and their conditions. We met with a fair number of stakeholders in the local communities in which each of these facilities are located to get their sense of the potential for privatization and their view of the performance and the value these facilities provide to the local communities. And, of course, we did a cost analysis, looking at the actual cost of operations and the efficiencies with which these facilities are operated. Just in way of an overview, as you're well aware, the Department of Juvenile Justice operates two types of programs for detained youth: secure detention, which is short-term detention for youth that are justice system involved, awaiting processing of their cases, and then treatment facilities, treatment programs, which are for longer-term stays for youth who have been adjudicated by the justice system. And again, the focus of this review was on the short-term detention facilities. In terms of overall trends, as you're probably well aware, the juvenile population, criminal justice population in the state's gone down substantially over the last 10 years. This is a national phenomenon. It's not limited to Alaska. Nationwide, juvenile crime is down by like 60% over the last 10 years. And we see the same trends here in Alaska, where criminal charges against juveniles have dropped over 50% in the last 10 years. Admissions to juveniles to secure detention has fallen commensurately. The average daily population of youth in secure detention has gone down by not as much as the admissions, but it has gone down substantially over the same time period. And again, the four facilities we looked at here, Kenai, Ketchikan, Matsu, and Nome, they were all opened in the early 2000s, basically in response to a surge in the juvenile justice population that was occurring in the 1990s. That surge, unfortunately, or fortunately, crested in the early 2000s, and the population has been in decline since then. This chart simply documents essentially the trend, which shows you charges, referrals, and actual unique juveniles in the system over 2006 to 2016. And you see a definite trend there, a reduction in nearly 50% over the time period. And the same with admissions to detention. The interesting factor here, you'll note that the decline was fairly constant through about FY13-14, and after that it's somewhat stabilized. And we see the same trend with the detention average daily population, a fairly steep decline through FY12-13, and since 14 it's been relatively stable. This is a profile of the system as it currently stands. We have facilities that house both detention beds and treatment beds. Those are the larger centers, McLaughlin in Anchorage, Bethel, the Johnson Youth Center here in Juneau, and the Fairbanks facilities. Those institutions house both detention units and treatment units. The standalone secure detention facilities, again, the focus of this study, are Matsu, Kenai, and Nome, in total about 39 beds in those facilities out of the total detention capacity of 106 for the department. In terms of juvenile detention privatization nationally, what we see is that a substantial number of facilities are contracted by units of government to house juveniles. Most of these, however, are in very small, non-for-profit settings, group homes, residential care. About 29% of the total juvenile justice population is in small, non-for-profit facilities of this type. They're very treatment-oriented. They're typically operated by social service agencies or non-for-profits. Use of private facilities for secure detention is relatively rare. The facilities that are out there tend to be fairly large, and there's not very many. About 8% of the secure population nationally is housed in private facilities. And those typically have a specific treatment focus, be it sex offender treatment, substance abuse treatment, something specialized along that nature. Okay, our approach to assessing feasibility, given these facilities' very small size, their location, we felt that the most feasible way to approach privatization of these specific facilities in the organizations would be to look at the organizations located locally in the community that may have an interest in establishing some type of relationship with DJJ to operate these facilities either in part or in total. So to that end, we went to each of these communities, interviewed tribal organizations, local public health agencies, behavioral health, residential care group providers, education system providers, other local not-for-profits, just to see if there were any local agencies that had any interest essentially in assuming some role in the operation or management of these specific facilities. We found basically no private or governmental organizations in any of these regions that had either the interest or the capability to operate standalone detention facilities for these youth. And given the absence of any organizations with an interest in privatization, we felt very clearly the concept's just not feasible at this time. So why was there no interest? What we found, and these were fairly common themes found in each community where we talked to the locals, one, they generally view juvenile detention, secure detention, as a very specialized field which requires a high degree of expertise, and one which they do not have necessarily any expertise of their own or experience. So they didn't really feel qualified or capable of taking on that type of responsibility or that type of program. Significant concerns were expressed about legal liability. These can be risky situations. We have youth that are troubled, that can be prone to suicide, that can be dangerous. So there's a significant risk of liability in the management of these facilities, which would necessarily entail some significant insurance costs on any private organization going in and assuming responsibility for their operation. Financial burden exposure, these are not cheap facilities to operate. They generally average around $2 million, some below, some slightly above. So it's a significant financial burden to take on the operation and management of these facilities. And given the uncertain nature where the population has been heading with these facilities, it's a significant financial risk for any organization to come in and take this on. Finally, again, uniformly in all the regions we went to, these organizations express profound respect for DJJ and the job that they do. The common comment that we heard was that the department's doing a fantastic job operating these facilities. Why would we want to come in and take over that job? Because we won't be able to do as good a job as they're doing. There was a lot of value placed on DJJ and their role in the communities, and for that reason, I think their preferred option was continued operation of these facilities by DJJ. We next looked at the potential for repurposing. So we looked at the advantages and disadvantages offered by the operation of these facilities in each of their communities. Starting with Kenai, the arguments we heard most prominently was that the location of that facility in that community is a public safety benefit, significant public safety benefit, because it allows law enforcement to maintain a community presence there as opposed to transporting youth back and forth on the road on the long trip to Anchorage. Law enforcement resources are limited, so the most, if they can maximize their presence in the community, that's a significant public safety factor. Community family access. It's a general principle in juvenile justice that if you can keep youth in the community and keep youth in contact with their families, with their local community, with their organizations they're familiar with, they do better. Their outcomes are better. Their chances of getting out of the justice system and becoming leading successful lives become better. So community and family access is a very significant, important benefit to having that facility in that community. Kenai also serves as a backup to McLaughlin in terms of providing backup detention capacity when McLaughlin reaches its limit, which does happen from time to time. So when that happens, McLaughlin has the ability to send kids to Kenai and relieve pressure on their situation. Kenai also, from time to time, houses kids in treatment who, for whatever reasons, need a smaller, more, I don't want to say congenial, but just a different environment than what's offered at McLaughlin. And in some instances, those kids in treatment tend to respond better to a smaller, more informal environment they find at an institution like Kenai. So there's that program offering there as well on an as-needed basis. In terms of facilities, the facility is relatively new, of course. It's got an outstanding design and offers a very good resource to the juvenile justice system. And finally, community support. There's very, very strong community support there for continued operation of the facility in its current use. The disadvantages in terms of utilization, in 2016, the facility was utilized at about a rate of 60% on average. And it's costly. It's about $2.1 million in 2016, an average annual cost of about $974 per youth per day. Now, in 2017, the population has trended up and it's approaching close to 10 youth per day, which is the facility's capacity. So, again, these population levels do fluctuate, and utilization has been on the rise in 2017 to date.
So, Mr. Becker, if you can hold for a question, Senator Machick.
I just quickly crunched the numbers here on full utilization. If you just looked at FY 2014, I'm assuming that the total spending cost is fairly consistent, whether you have average daily population of 6 or 10. Am I correct in that assumption, or is this 903.60 fairly consistent per day if there are 10 children versus 6?
Through the chair to the senator. The cost is consistent. The cost is 80%, 85% of the cost is staffing. And the staffing is basically fixed given the number of posts they have in the facility, whether there's 4 kids there or 10 kids. They basically have to have that number of staff over 3 shifts to operate the facility and keep it open. So the only variable costs really are food. Other than that, everything is pretty much fixed.
Follow up?
Yes, Senator Machick.
So was part of your study a consideration? I mean, I went through your presentation in advance, and I didn't see facilities that are fully utilized. Was that a consideration of yours on identifying sort of key facilities and perhaps others that, instead of privatization, whether or not there's a need for those beds and facilities at all when we're not operating at full capacity?
To the chair, to the senator, the continued operation of the facilities was really outside the scope of our study, what we attempted to look at was what specific advantages and disadvantages are offered by those facilities in their current use. And to the extent they're not being fully utilized and they're less efficient, that's certainly a major disadvantage which needs to be taken into account. We did take a look at the potential, what would happen, for example, if you would close a facility and move those kids out into, they have to go to someplace, obviously, of course. So if you were to go to another center, would that require, for example, at McLaughlin to open up a currently closed unit to accommodate the increased population? To the extent McLaughlin's at capacity, that would probably be a likelihood. If, in fact, you have to open up a new unit, you basically have to essentially add on the same number of staff or close to the same number of staff in the new unit as you'd have in the closed facility. So the savings, to the extent there would be any, would be very, very small.
And I have a quick question. Earlier in the presentation, you touched upon not finding any entities currently in these surrounding areas to take on sort of privatization of this. Did you run a model of cost of how much you figured the department would pay per juvenile to hold in their units to sort of throw that as a business model? And I understand DJJ, you know, they do wonders in the community. They have that impact in their communities, in my community. But you also touched upon that no one wanted to touch that because of that. Do you figure that was a reason why no one wanted to go ahead? Because you already said that almost 30% of the juvenile population are currently housed in private operating facilities, such as those group home residential care. None of those entities saw a use to expand their services and provide that same service to the department.
Well, to the chair, these are really two different types of populations. These kids are here for very short stays, essentially to stabilize them before they can be processed through the justice system for treatment or for further adjudication. So it's a different type of population and a different type of program to manage. In terms of the program model and looking at the cost, these facilities, in the way they're set up, essentially anyone who would want to operate these facilities would basically staff them in the way DJJ staffed them. They're staffing them at bare-bones levels currently. And to operate them, you need essentially the post structure and the staffing and the coverage levels that they have currently. So there's no ability, really, in our assessment, for a private provider to come in and substantially cut costs by reducing staff. I don't think that's possible. What you could possibly have is some savings in terms of reducing the salary levels of staff. But again, we did not model that. We're not familiar. We did not do research on what salary levels would necessarily could be afforded to people to continue working in these under a private situation. That's probably the only way to really get at that in an accurate sense is probably to issue an RFP and see what comes back in the way of responses.
Thank you. Please continue.
So in Kenai, again, we went to the community and asked for potential alternative uses, and nobody identified any potential use for the facility, and no local organizations had any interest in repurposing it. Again, the strong feeling locally was that they want the facility to continue in its current fashion. Matsu, similarly to Kenai, public safety was a significant concern, allowing law enforcement to maintain their presence in the community as opposed to trafficking kids back and forth to Anchorage. An advantage here, utilization. This facility operates pretty close to capacity at all times. And the population in the Matsu area, the youth population in the Matsu area is growing, so there is a potential, real potential here for increased demand for services at this institution. Again, similar to Kenai, the fact that the design is the same, the facility is outstanding, and there's very strong community support. Disadvantages, it's close to Anchorage. So, I mean, you could make an argument that because of its proximity, this area is already served by sufficient secure detention. You could make that argument. It wouldn't necessarily be accurate, but you could certainly try to make that argument. The downside to that argument, of course, is, again, McLaughlin is typically at capacity, so you'd have to open up another unit at McLaughlin, which would have some substantial cost involved. You see the cost there for Matsu, it's about $2.6 million. again, because it's higher, it's got a higher utilization rate, its cost per youth per day is substantially lower than the other facilities. Now, there were some potential alternative uses identified in talking to some of the community stakeholders, and two of the most prominent ideas that brought forward was the detoxification center, which was described as a strong community need, or potentially a transition step-down facility for youth leaving McLaughlin after treatment so they could transition back into the community at the end of their treatment phase at McLaughlin. Both of these alternatives, however, there's no funding for each of them, and it was made very clear they would be looking to the state for funding to support any type of repurposed function at the facility. Nome. Nome was a very unique and very interesting facility. Again, public safety. It's a little different twist here. There's a strong emphasis on keeping youth in the community there because of the remote nature, because of the special circumstances of the community, because they want to keep youth close to the community. So there was a feeling, I believe, that if the facility wasn't there, law enforcement would be less likely to perhaps commit kids to detention that could perhaps should be in detention, rather than faced with the choice of sending them very, very far away from their home communities. Again, we touched on location. This is the only juvenile detention facility within 600 miles. Community family access is particularly critical given the unique cultural needs of the community there. Youth programming. Nome does a fantastic job with youth programming, provide culturally appropriate programs. They're very supportive. It's a very, very unique facility in that respect. And, of course, community support here also is strong. Disadvantages, very low utilization. You can see it's got the lowest utilization in the department now that Ketchikan is closed. Physical plant maintenance costs, because of the nature of the location, the facility will require more resources to continue its operation. And, of course, the operating costs, as we noted, it's up also to $2.8 million in 2016. Now, in 2017, the population has rebounded somewhat. It's averaging around 8 youth per day, which is substantially above 2016. So, again, these average daily population figures do fluctuate somewhat. You can see in 2014 it was almost 9.5, and it is trending back upward in 2017. We tried to find alternative uses for the facility in the community. None were really offered up, but what was proposed was a modification of the facility's mission to incorporate a long-term post-adjudication treatment program there and dedicate 4 beds to that program. So it would basically become a dual mission facility, much like McLaughlin. In fact, it would have a secure detention component and a treatment component. And the target population here would be youth that are very difficult to place due to their clinical needs, that they're local, that they're Northwest Alaskan, or they're close to aging out of the juvenile justice system. And because of this, they have difficulty adjusting or have difficult placements elsewhere in the justice system. Nome already has the required mental health treatment. They've already got the required staffing, so the program could be implemented with basically no additional operating cost. And it would make better use of the facility and result in a more efficient operation of the facility, and establish a secure juvenile justice treatment alternative in the region, which currently isn't there. So there are those benefits to be offered by this type of program to be offered at Nome. Despite the fact that Ketchikan closed in 2016, we did take a look at that facility. As you're aware, the youth are now in Johnson Youth Center. There's no immediate plans for alternative use of the facility, and it is currently sitting vacant. We talked to local justice system officials about the impact that has been felt by the closure of the facility. Their concern is that detained youth have reduced access to courts and legal counsel because of the distance between their home community and Juneau. There's a potential, because they have reduced access or more limited access, there's a potential for longer stays in detention because they don't have access to the courts. I know the department's watching that very closely, and they're working to ensure that doesn't happen, but that is a concern. Case management, of course, is more difficult, and relocating youth, again, away from their community and family makes the management of these youth and the reintegration back in the communities more difficult. It can be done, of course, but it's more complex and it's more difficult. potential for repurposing. When we look over all the data and we look over the current use of the facilities, our conclusion was that the state of Alaska should continue to operate these facilities in their current function. They provide substantial value to their communities and to the state juvenile justice system, and that their highest and best use is continued operation as detention facilities. We saw no alternative purposes for any of these facilities that wouldn't result in that would result in cost savings to the state. We also were tasked with looking at facility operations, and very briefly here, we look at a lot of facilities like this around the country, and just want to reiterate that you have outstanding operations in all these units. I've seen personally dozens of these type of facilities across the United States, and these are some of the best in terms of programs, physical plant conditions, relationships between youth and staff that that we've seen. So they, in all instances, we saw outstanding operations, very efficient operations, and very good programs and relationships within staff and youth.
Continue?
Yes. Please. Almost done. We were also tasked to look at mental health services, which is a particular challenge and a big problem for juveniles and justice systems throughout the country. 56% of the youth in the system have a mental health diagnosis, so it's a concern that's felt throughout the system. The risk of suicide is very much a significant issue for youth in detention. So these are major concerns. What we saw was the department really trying to make the most of the resources they have. Mental health resources are strained. They put staff on the road to visit these facilities to provide services as needed. NOM does have a mental health clinician, which does provide good treatment up there. Matsu and Kenai basically share services that are provided through Anchorage. The system does have policies that are consistent with best practices for suicide prevention, so that's good. They're monitoring the situation. They're doing everything they can to keep on top of these issues. However, the system lacks a comprehensive plan for how to best meet the challenges it faces in delivering mental health services, and we think there should be some thought given to developing a plan to actually detail out how to make the most and best use of the mental health resources you have and meet those needs that are in the facilities. Our recommendations, our basic recommendations, boil down to four. We do not recommend privatization of detention facilities for juveniles. We recommend that you continue to operate Kenai, Matsu, and NOM in their current function. We would recommend you go ahead and develop that long-term treatment program for adjudicated delinquent youth at NOM. We think that could be a good benefit to the department and to the local community. And then we think the system could be improved by development of a comprehensive plan for mental health service delivery in detention facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Just quickly, this is probably a question for Ms. Murray. The state also came out with agreeing with the recommendations of this report. And during the same time of agreeing with those recommendations, the department's supplemental budget also came out, but there was still zero funding for the NOM facility. Does the department plan to ask for that request of to funding for NOM this year and for continued years, or what's sort of the purpose of the NOM facility at this time?
Through the chair, at this point, we are waiting direction from the legislature as to the NOM facility. We know that any closure of any facility is going to be impactful, and so we want to keep the services going. They're important in the communities, but at this point, we're waiting to see what the decision of the legislative session is.
So the department has no recommendation on opening or keeping it open or closed or asking for that funding?
Well, again, you know,
I'm just looking for a yes or no.
Yeah. Well, any facility is very important to the community, and so our support is to continue operation of services in the communities, the detention services.
Okay. Senator Begich.
Mr. Murray, just following up on that question, if the Director Murray, if the legislature chose to fund this facility, would it be the, is it your understanding that the department would recommend for or against vetoing that money?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, we would certainly go for the money, accept the funding, yes, support the funding.
Very brief follow-up.
Yes.
Combination of things. First, if we're going to be discussing this at length at any point in the future, perhaps we could bring it back to the committee since we're out of time, and I know you're conscious of the time, Mr. Chairman, but just for the record, the Nome facility existed before 2005. It was a detention facility before then. Has been around since the 90s and before. The remodel that was done by ECI Hire was designed by the communities. The community and professional input was part of that. So given that, isn't it true that the Ketchikan facility has been turned back to the city of Ketchikan at this point?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes. The facility is now in the hands of the Ketchikan community, yes.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki?
I have questions, but I'm going to put them in an email to you. I am a little worried about the average daily population, and we, on average, with the 3 years you provided, we have 15.5 empty beds in those years, and that inefficiency can't be cost-effective in a time with a $3.2 billion budget deficit. I think it's something we have to look at further. There are no services available for private operators in the state because the state has always risen to the challenge of providing those funds, and I don't know that I'd like to investigate somewhat of the private services that are available in other states because I can't believe you couldn't draw some of those entities to this one. But I have a series of questions that I'll provide to you to perhaps get an answer for the committee.
Yes, and at that time I think we should agree to invite the department back to for a little bit more follow-through on some of the discussions that we're having today.
Just a very brief last comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
To Senator Machicki, through the chair, there's been ample experience, which I'm happy to share with you after the committee meeting, Senator Machicki, about privatization in the juvenile justice systems in many states, and it has not been a pretty picture. So I'm happy to share that with you at some point.
Yeah. All right. So with that, I want to thank Mr. Carter and Ms. Murray for presenting, and thank you to the department. And this concludes our business for today. Our next committee meeting will be on Wednesday, February 8th, to hear and take public testimony on Senate Bill 20, List Use 47700, Pink as a Controlled Substance, as sponsored by Senator Meyer. And thus we're adjourned at 3:04 p.m.